Politics is moving to Friday. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette and the host of Max Politics here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Our show is moving from Wednesdays to Fridays at 5 p.m., so check me out then with guests including elected officials, advocates, candidates for office, experts on a wide variety of policy and political issues, and more. We're going in-depth with newsmakers, analysts, and other great guests every Friday starting in August at 5 p.m. here on WBAI.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Coming up next, what's going on with Linda Sarsour?
Good morning, WBAI listeners.
So I've had so many thoughts over the last couple of days that I thought I'd use this opportunity for this show to talk about them and then really talk about WBAI and myself and the platform that I've been given and how important it is for WBAI listeners to understand how important it is to support us here at the station. So, of course, you all heard the same news I did. Senator Raphael Warnock has defeated Herschel Walker and will be going back to the Senate for 6 years. He won't have to do a runoff for a little while. Poor guy was running every year. We're very, very grateful that he was able to squeak out of that race. Shout out to all the Georgia organizers. I mean, some of the most incredible humans I've ever met in my life. Just after the November election, these folks stayed on the street. They extended their work into this runoff. They never stopped. And just watching them, and I was had the privilege of being there for 2 weekends and seeing the positive attitudes, the hustle. Really, really just gave me so much hope, even in the dark times that we live. So shout out to Georgia organizers, most of whom are black and brown and really putting a lot on the line. And they really showed us what it looks like to be positive, to stay determined, to stay focused, and center the voters. What makes the win incredible, in Georgia is not just that Senator Warnock went back to the Senate. That's part of it. But amidst all the voter suppression that we heard yesterday from Greg Palasta, who's an investigative reporter, talking about some of the laws that have emerged under Brian Kemp and just the different tactics that are used by the Republican parties, particularly to suppress the vote, particularly of black and brown and poor folks in Georgia. So this win that happened is amidst some of the most draconian voter suppression tactics we've seen in a long time. So that's what makes this really remarkable. So of course, here at WBI, we can't congratulate Senator Warnock. You know, that doesn't mean we won't criticize him in his tenure as a full-term senator, because there will be times we won't agree with Senator Warnock, as we don't agree with many Democrats. But we want to say congratulations to Senator Warnock, because that's congratulating the people of Georgia that helped put him there. It's still sad because we have over 1.7 million people in Georgia went to the polls and decided Herschel Walker was the better candidate for them. And, you know, I'm one of those people that, you know, will say to folks is that there's a difference between a Republican candidate that we don't agree on or agree with on issues, for example. That's one thing. And, you know, not voting for them because we don't believe that they align with us or align with individual voters. That's one thing. But Herschel Walker was not that. He was absolutely outlandish, outrageous, and unqualified. That's just the bottom line. He was unqualified for this position. I mean, it would have been an absolute disaster to send someone like Herschel Walker to the Senate. Now, my point that I'm making is that, again, that what makes this race still a bit concerning is that there were 1.7 million people, over 1.7 million people in Georgia that decided that Herschel Walker was qualified, and they were willing to vote for him based on party lines and not, in fact, based on the fact that they thought he was actually qualified to go to the U.S. Senate. So that's still concerning. But what also gives me some solace in this past election season is watching states like Georgia and Arizona become true battleground states. And in fact, are indicating that they will be kingmakers in the potential in the presidential primaries and presidential election that comes in 2024. So woke up with the Raphael Warnock win. That's a good one. But there's so much more that I want to talk to you about today. But before we get into some of the other things, there's something that's happening today actually at the U.S. Supreme Court that I want to really talk about. I think a lot of these things either go over people's heads or they just may not be really focusing and paying attention with everything else that's happening in the world, but going to talk about that in a little bit. But we're going to go to the newscast first. I'm sure the newscast will talk a bit about the election results in Georgia and some other kind of democracy related issues that are happening, and may even touch on what I'm going to elaborate on after the newscast. So let's go to the newscast.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. The people have spoken.
Senator Raphael Warnock has been reelected in a runoff, defeating his Republican opponent Herschel Walker and giving Democrats a 51-seat majority in the Senate. Democrats will no longer have to negotiate a power agreement with Republicans over the next 2 years. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday in Moore v. Harper over a redrawn congressional district map by the North Carolina legislature. At its core, the case is focused on a widely discredited legal doctrine known as the independent state legislature theory, which would allow legislatures to set district boundaries without the possibility of review by state courts. Justice Alina Kagan says it would allow legislatures to engage in extreme gerrymandering.
I think what might strike a person is that this is a proposal that gets rid of the normal checks and balances on the way big governmental decisions are made in this country. And you might think that it gets rid of all those checks and balances at exactly the time when they are needed most.
Dr. Roy Guerrero, a Texas pediatrician who treated victims of the Uvalde school shooting earlier this year, was joined Wednesday at the Capitol by Senators Dick Durbin and Richard Blumenthal and members of the March 4th coalition to call for the Senate to vote on banning assault-style weapons during the lame duck session.
We are bleeding out and you are not there. You're sitting in your office filling out paperwork so you can get paid. And my oath as a doctor means I signed up to save lives. I do my job and I guess out. I am here to please do yours.
Senator Durbin said in his eyes, a made a rush to pass dozens of bills as the session ends. There is no more important issue. The House has already passed the measure. Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff and Jewish leaders participated in a discussion at the White House, which condemned a growing tide of anti-Semitic rhetoric by influential figures, some of whom have been associated with former President Donald Trump.
I will not remain silent, and I'm proud to be Jewish. I'm proud to live openly as a Jew, and I'm not afraid. We cannot live in fear.
Finally, in a now-deleted tweet, Arizona Republican Representative Paul Gosar agreed with Trump's call for the Constitution to be terminated over his unsubstantiated claims of election fraud. Gosar's tweet read in part, "Unprecedented fraud requires unprecedented cure." I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Good morning. Welcome back, WBAI listeners. That was our newscast for the day and sharing some really important updates, of course, based on the Georgia runoff election yesterday that, thank God, is sending Raphael Warnock back to the U.S. Senate. For folks who are just tuning in, it is 7:10. The time is moving too fast for me this morning, let me tell you. I stayed up too late last night reading all the hot takes about the Georgia election. So excuse me for not being too on point this morning. It's 54 degrees today, actually, in New York, which means it's warmer than the last couple of days. But there will be some thunderstorm watches. So be careful, folks, between around 11 to 1 p.m. So be careful, dress appropriately, and, you know, watch out for folks around you. I don't know if I'm going to venture outside today, but I have a lot of traveling coming up this week. So maybe I'll just stay home today in this rain. So as you heard in the newscast, something that I wanted folks to bring folks' attention to is that today, December 7th at 10 a.m., there will be a U.S. Supreme Court hearing on a case, Morgan versus Harper. And, you know, lots of folks, you know, there are, of course, folks who are in tune with, you know, voting rights and kind of just the news in general or kind of following this type of stuff will probably know about this. But for a lot of folks, because of all that is going on around us, are kind of missing this very important case. And really, this case could set a very bad precedent across the country. And as you heard in the newscast, pretty much what this Supreme Court hearing will allow for if they rule in favor of the gerrymanderers, which in this case, of course, are Republicans, that there could be really partisan gerrymandered maps that will pop up across the country. This case comes out of North Carolina, and it's based on this untenable misreading of the Constitution's election clause. And it's a debunked theory called the independent state legislator theory. And so basically, if the gerrymanderers kind of win in the Supreme Court around this case, Morgan versus Harper, basically what this would do, sorry, there's so much loud noise. It's New York City, folks. I can't help it. Basically, the proponents of this independent state legislator theory read the elections clause to give state legislators near exclusive authority to regulate federal elections. So prohibiting any other state entity like state courts or governors from placing checks and balances on that power. So in this case, the gerrymanderers are arguing that the theory licensed them to violate the state constitution when drawing congressional maps and that the state courts do not have the power to stop them. And so we've seen these gerrymandered maps across the country, and they've been mostly challenged in most of the states. And if this doesn't go well in the Supreme Court, this is a really hit to democracy and free elections. And so if I'll be following that today, and I'm hoping, I mean, today is just a hearing. They won't be doing an actual ruling today, but there you'll kind of the kind of arguments will be made. This the results of this hearing or the rulings around this case probably won't come until next year, sometime before July 2023. Usually, these big cases will be determined around June. So again, before the 2024 elections, which you know, of course, is a critical time for us to ensure that we have access to a free democracy. So that's Morgan versus Harper. Again, the hearing today is at 10 a.m. And so we'll be following that and kind of seeing what we glean from the arguments that are being made. But this is a very serious situation. And that's why it's important. And it's one of the important reasons why we need to codify the Voting Rights Act or expand and protect voting rights in America with passing the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And there's a few other pieces of legislation that have different focuses on when it comes to voting rights that, of course, haven't been able to be passed in the U.S. Senate, particularly over the last few years because of folks like Manchin and Sinema, Manchin out in West Virginia and Sinema out in Arizona, and which is why it was really important for us to ensure that Senator Warnock went back to the Senate because we have in this recent election had 50 to 49 and Warnock becomes the 51st vote. So it kind of makes one of those senators irrelevant, which was important to us because at the time we had a majority, but not really, if that makes sense. So that's Morgan versus Harper. And those are the kind of things that keep me up at night, folks, as we, you know, live in a country that promotes democracy around the world, that here we are, you know, trying to fight for the very little democracy we have left. And so again, this case really could set extremely bad precedent across the country, and potentially even deter voters who won't believe that their vote actually matters. And of course, if this, ruling is in favor of gerrymanderers, we already know that that, of course, is in favor of the Republican Party. And will build out seats that would benefit them and benefit their voters. And so, again, something to watch and something to kind of pay attention to. So that's been something that's on my mind and kind of been reading articles and trying to figure out where we're going to go from here. So that's Morgan versus Harper. The other interesting thing I've been thinking about and of course, you know, paying attention to this past couple of weeks or the last 2 weeks are, you know, the World Cup. And I know that it's been interesting following some of the conversations in more American-centric places where some folks are like, who cares about the World Cup? And I will say that, interestingly enough, that the World Cup is actually probably the most prominent sporting event that happens around the world. And in fact, it's very important to pretty much every other continent and nation in the world, except for folks in the United States. And I'm not saying that people in the United States don't watch the World Cup. They do. Oftentimes they are immigrants or children of immigrants and kind of have grown up watching the World Cup and watching football. And let's be clear here, it's football, folks. I know that Americans call something else football, but soccer is football. But in America, they call it soccer. And actually, the some American fans, of course, we don't know how to act when we leave the country. But American soccer fans went to Qatar, which is an Arab Muslim country where the World Cup is being held, and literally were in the stadium chanting, "It is soccer, it is soccer." And of course, they were not met with any empathy or sympathy, because in every other nation in the world, they call it football mostly. So the World Cup has been really interesting to watch for me, because I am Palestinian, as you all know, and just really watching the worldwide solidarity with the Palestinian people. You know, the World Cup this year was one of the few places in the world where you can be unapologetically in solidarity with the Palestinian people. You can unapologetically show symbols, specifically the flag of Palestine, wearing the keffiyeh. There were people from all over the world, anywhere from England to other parts of Africa. Most teams and their fans would raise Palestinian flags during games. Really, it was just an endearing for the Palestinian people to watch that type of solidarity, knowing that many of those governments have betrayed the Palestinian people, but seeing the fandom showing solidarity has been absolutely incredible. One of the highlights of this particular World Cup, and I think again, it's interesting to try to connect politics to sports, but we do that all the time, and especially here in the United States. Yesterday, and we've seen multiple actually games where, you know, the underdogs win, and that's what you want to see at the World Cup. You want upsets, and a beautiful upset that just happened was Morocco beating Spain. And Morocco is now the only African nation that has kind of went to this, kind of moved forward, in the World Cup. And it's been an incredibly, you know, beautiful scene, not only for the people of Morocco, but also, the African continent. And of course, you know, Arabs in general. I mean, the Moroccans, of course, as you know, they, you know, kind of share multiple identities with folks around the world. And one of the beautiful things about the win in Morocco, people are probably thinking like, okay, so Morocco beats Spain. First of all, Spain is an elite team, that is, quite competitive. So that was a big deal for Morocco to be able to defeat them. But what's interesting is I had traveled to Spain a few times. I'm doing some, transatlantic work and working and meeting activists and organizers in Spain, most of whom are North African, many of whom are Moroccan. And in fact, in a place like Spain, there, when you look at the population of their incarceration, or the percentage of their incarceration population is highly North African and Moroccan. You know, when you look at their poverty rates, and the communities that experience discrimination or that that experience, you know, discriminatory policies at the hands of the French government, you, of course, are people of color. But oftentimes you will find that because of the population of North Africans in Spain, it is North Africans. And of course, Muslims in particular, as you know, in France, they have laws against Muslim women in particular who wear hijab. So for example, in certain to go to certain universities, particularly public universities, women can't wear hijab, or getting jobs in the public sector like teachers and other civic kind of jobs. So it was something about the Morocco win in the World Cup against the colonizer. It really just there was something about it just really, warmed my heart a little bit. And I know it's something temporary. And it's, you know, people could argue that it's not transformative in that sense, but it was beautiful just to watch in that moment. And really proud of those Moroccan brothers, many of whom are born in Spain. And so they are playing for their country, but by extension, really that win was for their parents' home country, of Morocco. And of course the African continent. So I've been watching the World Cup, and if people are interested who I want to win the World Cup, I'd love to see Morocco, of course, win the World Cup. That would be absolutely incredible. Oh, and by the way, Japan played incredible. And we're really, I don't know. I was just inspired by the Japanese team, and the way that they conducted themselves, during the World Cup. But, I want, you know, Argentina to win. I'm a big Argentina fan. I want Messi to get his, you know, World Cup, as he kind of ventures out into might be his last World Cup. So, I want Argentina to win, but I would definitely accept the Morocco win, and that would be amazing. And so that is those are my thoughts on the World Cup. I think that there have been, of course, as you know, a lot of hot takes on Qatar being the hosting country of the World Cup, and the kind of hypocrisy around many in the West, talking about Qatar and kind of dicing and slicing, you know, laws in Qatar and, you know, how Qatar feels about certain issues. And I understand that. And there's no country that is beyond critique, but it's just rich, to hear that coming from, pundits in the United States and in the UK and others. I mean, come on. I mean, we are in a country that is, where women are fighting for, to make choices for themselves. You know, we have, high rates of racism and poverty, and, you know, we have, engaged in unjust wars and, killing millions in Iraq. And I could sit here for days and talk about, you know, why we are not the folks to be lecturing anyone about anything, and kind of need to clean our own backyard before we criticize other nations, even those who warrant criticism. So that's been interesting to watch, because that's kind of something that Americans do. We have we seem to find it very easy to criticize everyone and not really look inwards in our own country. And so that's kind of what I've been thinking about the World Cup. So, you know, we have some really good games coming up. And I think, again, it's just, it has really brought a lot of people together. I mean, watching the fandom from around the world in those stadiums in an Arab and Muslim majority country has been really intriguing to watch. So that's the World Cup. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to go to a quick break, and then we're going to come back. And I got some more thoughts to share with you and things that have been on my mind in the last couple of weeks. So we're going to go to break for a few minutes. You were listening to Americans by Janelle Monáe. So we've been talking about a lot here at WBAI this morning on what's going on around, of course, the incredible win for Senator Warnock. And of course, you know, it's a win where we must celebrate these wins, but also continue to stay vigilant and cautious as we move forward, knowing that, you know, over 1.7 million people in Georgia still believe that Herschel Walker was an adequate and qualified candidate to go to the U.S. Senate. So that, of course, is very worrying, seeing the kind of partisan divide that we still have, the polarization of voters based on party. That's something to kind of keep in mind. And I've said to people often, I've said this to people in the party, in the Democratic Party, and of course, other folks who do electoral organizing, that what Warnock race and some races that have, particularly in this last election, have proven is that we need to focus on expanding the electorate and investing in our electorate of young people, people of color, of new Americans, black voters, and not having to spend lots of resources trying to convert voters. I think that there are still many people who are eligible to vote in our communities who are either not registered to vote or have not yet found the motivation or the candidates that are going to inspire them to go to the polls. So let's just focus on expanding the electorate and ensuring that we focus on people who are going to be moved by issues. And of course, that is the responsibility of the Democratic Party to do that. And I know that many WBAI listeners, of course, are as frustrated as I have been for a long time with this kind of two-party system that we have. So I'm not saying that we don't work towards an alternative or something different. I'm just talking about in the meantime and using this as an opportunity for harm reduction as we think about what alternatives could look like. And it might not, you know, it might happen in my lifetime. It might not. But I think that there are people who are definitely thinking about this and doing the work. So what else do we got and what else have I been thinking about? I heard earlier in the show before this one, talking about Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, and also, you know, I heard something around record. It was a fundraising plea around records, by records. And I heard H-Rack Brown. And the reason why I bring that up is because when I hear Mumia Abu-Jamal and I hear H-Rack Brown, a.k.a. Imam Jamil Al-Amin, may they both see freedom soon and be back with their families. It reminds me about why WBAI is an important platform and Pacifica Station is important. And I make this plea to all of you, and I know you've heard this before from others, but the bottom line here, and I say this in my own personal experience, is that this is a place where you can assert voices like Mumia Abu-Jamal's, where you can say free Imam Jamil Al-Amin, H-Rack Brown, you know, where we could talk about the struggle for Palestinian liberation. This is a place that gives platform to people and issues that are marginalized in every other mainstream news outlets. This is a place that allows for me to share my thoughts. It's a place that allows us to insert into the conversation ideas and concepts that would be visible. It would be something you just don't hear. You won't hear it on other radio stations. You won't hear it on CNN or even MSNBC. And so WBAI is free speech radio. That's what it is. And you know, to be honest, when I think about myself as an activist, as an organizer, as a Palestinian, as a Muslim, you know, my people need voices like mine. And unfortunately, you know, we can sit here and analyze all major mainstream networks, even when talking about the issue around Palestine, Israel. Oftentimes you'll have an entire panel of people talking about the what's happening there, and there won't be not a single Palestinian. And if there is someone that may be somewhat from our community, it's often someone that's probably been vetted, who's going to share viewpoints that are not aligned with the majority of Palestinians and those who support Palestinians. You know, we've seen in the post 9/11 era, the justification of policies that have impacted, you know, Muslim Americans, particularly in the realm of national security. We have seen the erosion of civil liberties. We have seen the banging of the drum or the beating of the war drums that have resulted in thousands and thousands of innocent people who have been murdered at the hands of the United States government. And we need to talk about that. And we need to be able to give voices to those directly impacted people and the communities that they come from. And so that's what WBAI does. Like, this is not just, you know, here it's a radio show. You put on the show, you know, this network during the day, you're listening to it, you know, getting ready for work or at work while you're, you know, at your job. This WBAI means so much to communities that have been invisibilized in this country. And so, you know, we ask you to support WBAI. This is not just another, you know, oh, some more people asking me for money. This is about sustaining free speech. This is about sustaining the centering of voices of marginalized people in a very profound way. You know, when I wake up on Wednesday mornings to be on the show, I wake up with a lot of joy and a lot of intention, because I know that a lot of people count on my voice and count on hearing voices like mine. And, you know, just knowing that folks like my mom listened to me on the radio, so she could hear a perspective and hear things that, you know, not only she can learn, but also hearing perspectives that she believes herself to be represented on radio, you know, on 99.5 FM, folks. I mean, WBAI is an important part of our larger movements and giving us the opportunity to communicate with listeners and trying to expand our listenership so people can. Most of our listeners, of course, are incredible human beings who already generally align. But there are many times where we share things that people will email me and say, you know, I never thought about it that way. Or, you know, thank you for sharing that. Oh, I want to, you know, learn more about this. And so I appreciate when people reach out to me. And so we're going to keep asking you. It's the end of the year. And WBAI is not run for free, you know, and I always say, I heard someone say this before, freedom is not free. And freedom of speech is not free, unfortunately, in many spaces. So in order for WBAI to continue this work, to continue to give platforms and to ensure that our producers are paid, ensuring that our studio rent is paid, we need you. We just can't do this without you. And I would be devastated if there was ever a moment that we had to come on the radio and say, this is our last show, or this is the end of the road for Pacifica. So please, please think about adding us to your end of year donation. If you can be a sustaining donor to WBAI, please do that. Again, you know, sometimes we have all this criticism of mainstream media and really pointing out where they kind of miss the mark. You know, why are they not inserting certain voices? Why do folks who are, you know, warriors for social justice, why are we not talking about or using certain terminology or hearing certain terminology on national television or even national radio? We need to put our money where our mouth is. If that's what we want to hear, if we want to build an institution that is focused on telling the truth and centering marginalized voices, we got to pay for it. And that's the bottom line. So if you are someone who's thinking about organizations or causes to give to for the end of the year, please put WBAI on your list. And it's very easy to give to WBAI. If you go to WBAI.org, I mean, it's right there. Once you open the page, it gives you an opportunity to donate, to become a BAI sustaining donor. They call it a BAI buddy. I'd love for me to have some buddies that give specifically to this show. You know, many of the folks here, you know, for myself, you know, I'm just so grateful to have this platform and whatever resources go back to the larger, you know, budget to ensure that WBAI continues to be a strong entity that continues to center, again, voices of marginalized people and, you know, allows us to speak the truth on the many issues that, you know, are so critical to this time. And so please, folks, WBAI. And again, an example is, you know, one of the thoughts I've had or things I've been thinking about over the last few days is about a new film that is now out on Netflix called Farha. Farha means happiness or the happiness. And it's a Netflix film. It's a movie, not a documentary, but it's a film. That is the country of Jordan's official submission to the Oscars. And it's telling, it's inspired by true events of the Nakba, which many folks know translates to the catastrophe. It's what the Palestinian peoples, it's basically when the state of Israel was created, the Palestinian people called that the Nakba, the catastrophe. And it is a film on Netflix that is told through the eyes of a Palestinian girl who has aspirations to leave her small village in Palestine to go pursue an education. And there's a little push and pull with her father, who happens to be the mayor of their small town. And you know, her dreams are deferred because horror takes place. And the reason why it's important for me to talk about Farha is because the Israeli government has been melting down after Netflix announced that this will be airing on December 1st on Netflix. And They are claiming that it is, you know, over exaggerated, that it's not true, basically engaging in Nakba denial, which is anti-Palestinian racism. And it's actually disgusting and horrific that anybody would deny that in order for the state of Israel to have been created, there had to have been Palestinians, thousands of Palestinians who were displaced, some of whom were murdered, over close to 500 villages destroyed. Like, that happened. You know, no one can deny that experience of Palestinians in order for the state of Israel to be created. And I tell people all the time, my grandmother was born in 1927, which was 21 years before the creation of the state of Israel, and was not a child. And of course, had many recollections and memories of the Nakba. And so our stories of pain, of trauma, of horror should not be negated. And it does not take away from others' experiences and stories of the horror that their families experience. But the Palestinian people also do not have much platforms or avenues or venues to tell their stories. And so Farha is one of those storytelling tools that is now on a mainstream streaming platform, Netflix. And, you know, listen, I'm not one to sit here and give kudos to any corporation, but I will say that, you know, with all the pressure that Netflix has been receiving, they have not cowered. The Farha is still available for streaming, and in some parts of the world, it is pretty prominent on the main page of the Netflix homepage when you get on Netflix. So watch Farha, folks. I think that, you know, one of the things that is important for us as consumers, whether we like it or not, in this kind of capitalistic system, is that if we're going to consume, we might as well find ways to, you know, collectively consume and send messages to streaming networks like Netflix, that which millions of people around the world, if not more than that, have access to, that these are the kind of stories we also want to see. These are films that we want to see. And so, of course, giving it, you know, thumbs up on Netflix helps to hire the algorithm for it. And it also helps to connect you to other recommendations of Palestinian directed or Palestinian centered films on those types of streaming platforms. So Farha, it's F as in Frank, A-R-H-A, Farha, which is on Netflix. And so that is, again, you know, this has been the deadliest year for the Palestinians in quite a while. There have been over, I believe, somewhere close to 200 or maybe 240 something people who've been killed this year. 47 of them are children. And of course, stories like that of the results of the brutal military occupation by the Israeli government, the crackdowns on Palestinians in the West Bank, largely are gone untold. And if it wasn't for social media and for Palestinian accounts and activists, and of course, determined journalists, many of whom are freelance and independent, who are telling those stories, whether it be Palestinians murdered at the hands of the state of Israel or at the hands of violent settlers. Those are, again, stories that we can and share here on Pacifica Radio, on WBAI. This is a place where we are not censored, where we can critique the state of Israel, where we can, you know, we will be having a show shortly around the recent political developments in Israel. You know, so it's interesting to hear a lot of takes about the current formation of the Israeli government, which is extremely right wing. But of course, Palestinians would argue that, you know, living under a brutal military occupation, you know, there hasn't really been any government that really has been, you know, good, quote, good to the Palestinian people. But this particular government now in the recent elections, you know, bringing Netanyahu back into the fold, is extremely right wing, like the right wing of the right wing. And it's a very dangerous and volatile time right now in Palestine, especially in the West Bank. So again, WBAI is where we can have these conversations, where we can bring experts and folks, especially Palestinians, to be able to kind of give us context and allow us to understand not only what's actually happening on the ground, but the implication of what's happening, how the Palestinian people are feeling and reacting to what's happening on the ground, and also what we can do to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation and freedom. So again, that's what WBAI does, folks. You know, again, this, I, as you know, have been, you know, censored from some spaces because I'm a vehement critic of the state of Israel, and that is something that I will always be. So I wasn't going to change myself. You know, I wasn't going to apologize for carrying these views and believing them in my heart as a Palestinian, but I believe that I would have been in solidarity with the Palestinian people, even if I wasn't Palestinian. But the point is here that if we're going to have people be unapologetic about their positions, particularly those who are principled when it comes to social justice and human rights, then we need to support platforms like WBAI. This is just the bottom line, folks. Like, we cannot be on air without you. And, you know, looking at, you know, kind of, as you know, many nonprofit organizations right now are looking at their end of year, what they're going to be working with for 2023. People start crunching the numbers now. And that's what folks at WBAI are doing, crunching the numbers. And we want to be able to freely flow in 2023. And we can't do that without you. You know, look, we have, you know, Donald Trump recently announced that he was running for president. And, you know, I don't even necessarily care about that. I don't think that Donald Trump could ever win again. But what he will be able to do is create a lot of chaos. And then we'll have more Republican candidates that will be vying for the Republican nomination, which means that everybody's going to be fighting to be the most right. And I don't mean right as in accurate. I mean, ideologically. And so we're going to start seeing an increase again in rhetoric that is, you know, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-Black, you know, exclusively and unequivocally pro-law enforcement and pro-military, you know, anti-LGBTQ, anti-marginalized people, anti-Indigenous rights. I mean, we're just going to hear all of it. And we need to have spaces like WBAI to really be able to cut through that. And not only just on Republicans, but look, Democrats too. You already know how I feel about that. We again are going to potentially go up in a Democratic primary. We don't know yet for sure if Joe Biden's running for a reelection. And even if he does, we don't know if there are going to be challengers to the reelection of President Joe Biden. So again, having spaces to have the honest kind of uncensored conversations, critiques, and bringing folks to share their views on what's going to be going on in 2023 is important. And we're not going to be able to have the full truthful conversation without platforms like WBAI. So again, I want a free flow for everyone and all the hosts that we have at WBAI, very incredible people that have really helped shape. Some have been on the air for way longer than I have, some for decades, and are still here and are still strong. Many shows that have been around for a really long time. So I'm proud of where WBAI has come. And I know that they would not have gotten here without the support of listeners. And I hope that you continue to support WBAI. So whatever you can give, $50, $100, $1,000. I know that there might be some WBAI listeners that can give more than that. But I also know that there are some that can give $5. So whatever you can give to WBAI, again, keeps voices like mine and many others on the radio. And so I hope that we get a report soon that more folks have joined in supporting WBAI. You know, another thoughts that I've been having over the last kind of few weeks. I've been kind of on social media, but not really, really trying to do some quiet, busy work. You know, many of us, as you know, also run nonprofits and are, you know, doing a lot of administrative work, grant writing, deadlines. I do a lot of capacity building for small nonprofit organizations. So making sure that the people I work with are getting my full and undivided attention, doing a lot of traveling. I start this week in Colorado, at a meeting with Free Speech TV and then going to the American Muslim Advisory Council's 10th anniversary out in Nashville, Tennessee, because we have a burgeoning Muslim American community out there that's been really engaged civically. So I'm excited about that. And then I go from there to the National Immigration Integration Conference. It's called NIC. It happens in kind of the greater Baltimore area. And so there will be about close to 1,300 immigrant rights activists who will descend on Baltimore at a convention center there. And I'm really excited about that and just being with folks to you know, strategize. As you know, because of the pandemic, many of these conventions have ceased to happen in person. So getting people back together in spaces, trying to have as much safety precautions as possible, knowing that there has also been a rise in COVID, is that's kind of the next trip, that I have. And then going from there to the National Coalition for Black Civic Participation, celebrating their 25th anniversary, and they're honoring, myself, Tamika, and the Until Freedom family. So I'm really excited about that. And again, just being in space with some of the incredible people that were kind of leading efforts in Georgia. So it's a busy time. Hopefully there'll be time for me to wind down during this holiday season, but there's a lot going on. And the reason why I share all of that with you is because there's been a really important conversation that has been happening and things that have been unfolding that I think we need to focus on, and just kind of want to put my thoughts out there before I sign off for this week. There has been an absolute, and for the times that I am on social media, I see it. There has been definitely a visible increase in anti-Semitic rhetoric online. And, you know, sometimes when I'm on Threads and I see people having this discussion and seeing how our Jewish family is, you know, experiencing this, I want to explain to people and share a story to give people some color to this conversation. When 9/11 happened, the horrific attacks of 9/11 happened, and over 3,000 of our fellow Americans were murdered in probably the worst terrorist attack on the United States. The United States government's response to that was to crack down on Muslim communities, many of whom immigrant communities across the country. You know, I remember as a young person out in Southwest Brooklyn watching every level of law enforcement descend on the communities that I was born in, that I loved, anywhere from NYPD intelligence to the Federal Bureau of Investigations to other law enforcement agencies that I had never heard of, watching men in our community being detained, you know, watching the increase of, you know, men that were pretty much getting kidnapped by the United States government. And so not only was it just the crackdown from the government on our communities that had absolutely nothing to do with this horrific attack. Watching our neighbors turn on us, some neighbors turn on us, and people who decided that their Muslim neighbors were the enemies within. And it was a very isolating and challenging time for Muslim immigrants here in the New York City area. And I remember this so clearly. I was only like 21 years old, watching Jewish neighbors across New York City, Jewish activists and organizers and groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, and just rabbis and synagogues across New York City, who came to stand at mosques on Fridays to ensure that worshipers felt safe to go and pray on Fridays. You know, the solidarity and allyship that we were shown by and continue to be shown by our Jewish family in New York City and across the country has been something that really has given me the determination to keep moving forward and to understand that we're all we got. And the reason why I share that is because seeing the Jewish community step up for their Muslim neighbors in the post 9/11 world, after hearing an increase in anti-Muslim rhetoric and the vilification of Muslim Americans and Muslim immigrants, and the demonization of our community, really casting us as suspect, was something that was very familiar to Jewish people. And so that's why they ring the alarms when they hear demonization, and vilification of Jewish people, because in 2001, the proximity to something as horrific as the Holocaust was only like 60 years. Like, what people need to understand is that we're talking about something that's still fresh in the minds of people. Some folks are the great-grandchildren or grandchildren of. We still have some folks amongst us who are still alive, who experienced that horror. And so when you see words to people are not just words. It's not that, remember back in the days when you were young, they used to teach you sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. No, words do hurt. Words, if left unchecked, if hatred and bigotry is left unchecked, it could cause harm and violence to people. And so this is important for us to sit with. And as we see any rhetoric online that is engaging in, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, anti any marginalized group, we need to step in. And, especially if it's people that we know personally, being able to have those courageous conversations, say, this is not right. Let me correct you. Let me have a conversation with you. Let me introduce you to someone from this community, is something that we all have a responsibility to do. So that's been something that's been on my mind watching the conversation, especially around someone like Kanye, who has such a large platform and is using it so dangerously and irresponsibly. And I want to make sure that, I'm unequivocal and clear where I stand on this. So, I see you, and I know that being online sometimes creates a lot of trauma for folks. I believe in us. I believe that we're in this together, and that we would continue to show each other radical solidarity, even when we don't agree on some issues. So we're going to keep watching that unfold. And I think just, again, people being able to speak up and be in solidarity and just tell someone else that feels unsafe that we got you, we see you, is important in this moment. So I appreciate you all, WBAI listeners, for being on the radio with us, for listening to WBAI, for continuing to support our work. Again, folks, WBAI.org. Give what you can. Just say to yourself today, make that commitment and say, you know what? Today, when Linda gets off the air, I'm going to go to WBAI.org and I'm going to give something. I'm going to give in commitment to democracy. I'm going to give in commitment to free speech, and in commitment to centering voices of marginalized people who are invisibilized elsewhere. So until next week, folks, I appreciate you all. And I hope to be back next week on What's Going On with Linda Sarsour.
This is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Join us November 25th to December 11th for the 30th annual African Diaspora International Film Festival. The festival is back in person in Manhattan with guest filmmakers, moments of reflection, and a great selection of 89 award-winning, socially relevant narrative and documentary films from 44 different countries. Celebrate Black love, enjoy music films, and film theater, a spotlight on South Africa cinema and Afro-European actors, and discover new independent voices in the Black cinema world. The 30th annual African Diaspora International Film Festival from November 25th until December 11th. Details at nyadiff.org or call 212-864-1760.